Chapter 9. How dreadful, how perfectly dreadful, whimpered Lassalarine. Oh, darling, I am so frightened. I'm shaking all over. Feel me. Come on, said Avarice, who was trembling herself. They've gone back to the new palace. Once we're out of this room, we're safe enough. But it's wasted a terrible time. Get me down to that water gate as quick as you can. Darling, how can you? Squeaked Lassalarine. I can't do anything, not now. My poor nerves. No, we must just lie still a bit and then go back. Why back? Arborus asked. Oh, you don't understand. You are so unsympathetic, said Lassalarine, beginning to cry. Arborus decided it was no occasion for mercy. Look here, she said, catching Lassalarine and giving her a good shake. If you say another word about going back, and if you don't start taking me to that water gate at once, do you know what I'll do? I'll rush out into that passage and I'll scream. Then we will both be caught. But we shall both be killed, said Lassalarine. Didn't you hear what the Tizrock, may he live forever, said? Yes, and I'd sooner be killed than married to Ashta, so come on. Oh, you are unkind, said Lassalarine, and I in such a state. But in the end, she had to give in to Avarice. She led the way down the steps they had already descended, and along another corridor, and so finally out into the open air. They were now in the palace garden, which sloped down in terraces to the city wall. The moon shone brightly. One of the drawbacks about adventure is that when you come to the most beautiful places, you are often too anxious and hurried to appreciate them. So that Arvis, who, though she remembered them years later, had only a vague impression of gray lawns, quietly bubbling fountains, and the long black shadows of cypress trees. When they reached the very bottom and the wall rose frowning above them, Lassalarine was shaking so that she could not unbolt the gate. Arvis did it. There at last was the river, full of reflected moonlight, and a little landing stage and a few pleasure boats. Goodbye, said Arvis, and thank you. I'm sorry if I've been a pig, but think what I'm flying from. Oh, Arvis, darling, said Lassalarine, won't you change your mind, now that you've seen what a very great man Ashta is? Great man, said Arvis, a hideous, groveling slave who flatters when he kicks but treasures it all up and hopes to get his own back by egging on that horrible Tizrock to plot his son's death. I'd sooner marry my father's scullion than a creature like that. Oh, Arvis, Arvis, how could you say such dreadful things? And about the Tizrock, may he live forever, too. It must be right if he's going to do it. Goodbye, said Arvis. And I thought you're just as lovely, and I think your house is lovely, too. I'm sure you'll have a lovely life, though it wouldn't suit me. Close the door softly behind me. She tore herself away from her friend's affectionate embraces, stepped into a punt, cast off, and a moment later was out in midstream with a huge real moon overhead and a huge reflected moon down, deep down in the river. The air was fresh and cool, and as she drew near the farther bank, she heard the hooting of an owl. Ah, that's better, thought Arvis. She had always lived in the country and had hated every minute of her time in Tashban. When she stepped ashore, she finally found herself in darkness, for the rise of the ground and the trees cut off the moonlight. But she managed to find the same road that Shasta had found, and came just as he had to the end of the grass and the beginning of the sand, and looked like him to her left and saw the big black tombs. And now at last, brave girl though she was, her heart quailed. Supposing the others weren't there, supposing the ghouls were, but she stuck out her chin and a little bit of her tongue too, and went straight towards them. But before she reached them, she saw Brienne, Wynne, and the groom. You can go back to your mistress now, she said Arvis, quite forgetting that he couldn't until the city gates opened the next morning. Here is money for your pains. To hear is to obey, said the groom, and at once set off at a remarkable speed in the direction of the city. There was no need to tell him to make haste. He also had been thinking a good deal about ghouls. For the next few seconds, Arvis was busy kissing the noses and patting the necks of Huin and Bree, just as they were quite ordinary horses. And here comes Sasha, thanks be to the lion, said Bree. Argus looked round, and there, right enough, was Shasta, who had come out of hiding the moment he saw the groom going away. "And now," said Argus, "there is not a moment to lose," and in hasty words she told them about Rabadash's expedition. "Treacherous hounds," said Bree, shaking his mane and stamping his hoof. "An attack in time of peace without defiance sent? But we'll grease his oats for him. We'll be there before he is." "Can we?" said Iris, swinging herself into Huen's saddle. Shasta was wishing he could mount like that. "Pooh," said snorted Bree. "Up you get, Shasta. Can we? And with a good start, too." "He said he was going to start at once," said Arvis. "That's how humans talk," said Bree. "But you don't get a company of 200 horses and horsemen watered and ridiculed and armored and saddled and started all in a minute. Now, what's our direction? Due north?" "No," said Shasta. "I know about that. I've drawn a line. I'll explain later. Bear a bit to our left, both your horses. Ah, here it is." "Now," said Bree, All that about galloping for a day and a night, like in stories, can't really be done. It must be walk and trot, but brisk trots and short walks. And whenever we walk, you two humans can slip off and walk too. Now, are you ready, Quinn? Off we go, Narnia in the north." At first, it was delightful. The night had now been going on for so many hours that the sand had almost finished giving back all the sun heat it had received during the day, and the air was cool, fresh, and clear. Under the moonlight, the sand, in every direction and as far as they could see, gleamed as if it were smooth water or a great silvery tray. Except for the noise of Breeze and Huen's hoofs, there was not a sound to be heard. Shasta would nearly have fallen asleep if he had not had to dismount and walk every now and then. This seemed to last for hours. Then there came a time when there was no longer any moon. They seemed to ride in the dead darkness for hours and hours. And after there had been come a moment when Shasta noticed that he couldn't see Bree's neck and head in front of him a little more clearly than before, and slowly, very slowly, he began to notice the vast gray flatness on every side. It looked absolutely dead, like something in a dead world, and Shasta felt quite terribly tired and noticed that he was getting cold and his lips were dry. All the time, and the squeak of the leather, the jingle of the bits, the noise of the hooves, not property as it would have been on hard road, but thumpy on the dry sand. At last, after hours of riding, far away on his right, there came a single long streak of paler gray, low down on the horizon, then a streak of red. It was the morning at last, but without a single bird to sing about it, he was glad of the walking bits for now, for he was colder than ever. Then suddenly the sun rose and everything changed in a moment. The gray sand turned yellow and twinkled as if it was strewn with diamonds. On their left, the shadows of Shasta and Huen and Bree and Arvis, enormously long, raced beside them. The double peak of Mount Pyre far ahead flashed in the sunlight, and Shasta saw they were a little off out of the course. A bit left," he sang out. Best of all, when he looked back, Tashban was already small and remote. The tombs were quite invisible, swallowed up in that single jagged-edged hump which was the city of the Tizrock. Everyone then felt better, but it wasn't to last for long. Though Tashban looked very far away when they first saw it, it refused to look any further away as they went on. Shasta gave up looking back at it, for it only gave him the feeling that they weren't moving at all. Then the light became a nuisance. The glare of the sand made his eyes ache, but he knew he mustn't shut them. He must screw them up and keep looking on ahead at Mount Pyre and shouting out directions. Then came the heat. He noticed it for the first time when he had to dismount and walk. As he slipped down to the sand, the heat from it struck up to his face as if from the opening of an oven door. The next time he got down, it was worse. But the third time, as his bare feet touched the sand, he screamed with pain and got one foot back in the stirrup and the other half over Bray's back before he could have said knife. "Sorry, Bree," he gasped. "I can't walk. It burns my feet." "Of course," said Bree. "Should have thought of that myself. Stay on. Can't be helped." It's all right for you, said Shasta to Arvis, who was walking beside Swin. You've got shoes on. Arvis said nothing and looked prim. Let's hope she didn't mean to, but she did. On again, trot and walk and trot, jingle, 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 squeak, 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 smell of hot horse, smell of hot self, blinding glare and headache, nothing at all different for mile after mile. Tashman would never look any further away. The mountains would never look any nearer. He felt this had been going on for always. Jingle, 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 squeak, 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 smell of hot horse, smell of hot self. Of course, one tried all sorts of games with oneself to try and make the time pass, and of course, they were all no good. And one tried very hard not to think of drinks, like iced sherbet in a palace at Tashban, clear spring water tinkling in the dark, earthy sound, cold, smooth milk just creamy enough and not too creamy, and the harder you tried not to think about it, the more you thought of it. At last, there was something different. A mass of rock sticking up out of the sand, about 50 yards long and 30 feet high. It did not cast much shadow, for the sun was now very high, but it cast just a little. Into that shade they crowded. There they ate some food and drank a little water. It was not easy giving a horse a drink out of a skin bottle, but Bree and Huen were very clever with their lips. No one had anything like enough. No one spoke. The horses were flecked with foam, and their breathing was noisy, and the children were pale. After a very short rest, they went on again. The same noises, same smell, same glare, till at last their shadows began to fall on their right. Then got longer and longer till they seemed to stretch out to the eastern end of the world. Very slowly the sun drew near to the western horizon, and now at last he was down, and thank goodness the merciless glare was gone. Though the heat coming up from the stand was still as bad as ever. Four pairs of eyes were looking out eagerly for any sign of the valley that shallow pad the raven had spoken about. But mile after mile there was nothing but level sand. Now the day was quite definitely done, and most of the stars were out. And still the horses thundered on, and the children rose and sank in their saddles, miserable with thirst and weariness. Not till the moon had risen did Shasta, in his strange barking voice of someone whose mouth is perfectly dry, shouted out, "There it is!" There was no mistaking it now. Ahead and a little to their right, there was at last a slope downward in hummocks of rocks on each side. The horses were far too tired to speak, but they swung round toward it, and in a minute or two, they had entered the gully. At first, it was worse in there than it had been in the open desert, for there was a breathless stuffiness between the rock walls and less moonlight. The slope continued steeply downward, and the rocks on either hand rose on the height of the cliffs. Then they began to meet vegetation, prickly cactus-like plants and coarse grass of the kind that would prick your fingers. Soon the horse hooves were falling on pebbles and stone instead of sand. Round every bend of the valley, it had many bends, they looked eagerly for water. The horses were nearly at the end of their strength now, and Huen, stumbling and panting, was lagging behind Bree. They were almost in despair before at last they came to a little muddiness and a little trickle of water through softer and better grass. And the trickle became a brook, and the brook became a stream with bushes on each side. And the stream became a river, and there came, after more disappointment than I could possibly describe, a moment when Shasta, who had been in kind of a doze, suddenly realized that Bree had stopped and found himself slipping off. Before them, a little cataract of water poured into a broad pool, and both the horses were already in the pool with their heads down, drinking, drinking, drinking. "Oh," said Shasta, and plunged in. It was about up to his knees, and stooped his head right into the cataract. It was perhaps the loveliest moment in his life. It was about 10 minutes later when all four of them, the two children nearly wet all over, came out and began to notice their surroundings. The moon was now high enough to peep down into the valley. There was soft grass on both sides of the river, and beyond the grass, trees and bushes sloped up on the bases of cliffs. There must have been some wonderful flowering shrubs hidden in the shadowy undergrowth, for the whole glade was full of the coolest and most delicious smells. Out of the darkest recesses among the trees, there came a sound Shasta had never heard before, a nightingale. Everyone was much too tired to speak or eat. The horses, without waiting to be unsaddled, lay down at once. So did Arvis and Shasta. About 10 minutes later, the careful Hoen said, "But we mustn't sleep. We've got to keep ahead, Rapidash." "No," said Bree very slowly, "mustn't go sleep. Just a little rest." Shasta knew for a moment that they would all go to sleep if he didn't get up and do something about it, and he felt as though he ought to. In fact, he decided that he would get up and persuade them to go on, but presently, not yet, just not yet. Very soon, the moon shone, and the nightingale sang over 2 horses and 2 human children, all fast asleep. It was Arvis who woke first. The sun was already high in the heavens, and the cool morning hours were already wasted. "It's my fault," she said to herself furiously as she jumped up and began rousing the others. One wouldn't expect horses to keep awake after a long day's work like that, even if they can talk. And of course that boy wouldn't. He's not had any decent training. But I ought to have known better. The others were dazed and stupid with the heaviness of their sleep. "Hey, oh, Bru," said Bree, "been sleeping in my saddle, eh? I'll never do that again. Most uncomfortable." "Oh, come on," said Arvis. "We've lost half the morning already. There isn't a moment to spare." "The fellow's got to have a mouthful of grass," said Bree. "I'm afraid we can't wait," said Arvis. "What's the terrible hurry?" said Bree. "We've crossed the desert, haven't we?" "But we're not in Archenland yet," said Arvis, "and we've got to get there before Rapidash." "Oh, we must be miles ahead of him," said Bree. "Haven't we been coming a shorter way? Didn't that raven friend of yours say that it was a shortcut, Shasta?" "He didn't say anything about shorter," answered Shasta. "He just said better, because he got to a river this way. If the oasis is doing the Tashban, then I'm afraid that this may be longer." "Well, I can't go on without a snack," said Bree. "Take my bridle off, Shasta." "Please," said Hoen very shyly. I feel just like Bree, that I can't go on." "But when horses have humans with spurs and things on their backs, aren't they often made to go on when they're feeling like this? And they find they can? Aren't we be able to do more even now that we're free? It's all for Narnia." "I think, ma'am," said Bree very crushingly, "that I know a little more about campaigns and forced marches and what a horse can stand than you can. You do." To this, Hoen made no answer. Being like most highly bred mares, a very nervous and gentle person was easily put down. In reality, she was quite right, and if Bree had had a Tarkhan on his back at that moment to make him go on, he would have found that he was good for several more hours hard going. But one of the worst results of being a slave and being forced to do things is that when there is no one to force you anymore, you find you have lost the power of forcing yourself. So they had to wait while Bree had a snack and a drink, and of course, Hoen and the children had a snack and a drink, too. It must have been nearly 11 o'clock in the morning before they finally got going again, and even then, Bree took things much more gently than yesterday. It was really Hoen, though. She was smaller and weak and more tired of the two, who set the pace. The valley itself, with its brown, cool river and grass and moss and wild flowers and rhododendrons, was such a pleasant place that it made you want to ride slowly. Chapter 10. After they had ridden for several hours down the valley, it widened out and they could see that what was ahead of them. The river which they had been following here joined a broader river, wide and turbulent, which flowed from their left to their right towards the east. Beyond this new river, a delightful country rose gently in low hills, ridge upon ridge, to the northern mountains themselves. To the right, there were rocky pinnacles, one or two of them with snow clinging to the ledges. To the left, pine-clad slopes, frowning cliffs, narrow gorges, and blue peaks stretched away as far as the eye could reach. He could no longer make out Mount Pyre. Straight ahead, the mountain range sank to a wooden saddle, which, of course, must be the pass from Archenland into Narnia. "Bru, the north, the green north," neighed Bree. And certainly the lower hills looked greener and fresher than anything that Arvis and Shasta, with their southern red eyes, had ever imagined. Spirits rose as they clattered down to the waters meet of the two rivers. The eastern flowing river, which was pouring from the higher mountains at the western end of the range, was far too swift and too broken with rapids for them to think of swimming it. But after some casting about up and down the bank, they found a place shallow enough to wade. The roar and clatter of water, the great swirl against the horse's fetlocks, the cool, stirring air, and the darting dragonflies filled Shasta with a strange excitement. "Friends, we are in Archon Land," said Bree proudly, as he splashed and churned his way out on the northern bank. "I think that river we've just crossed was called the Winding Arrow." "I hope we're in time," murmured Wynne. Then they began going up, slowly and zigzagging a good deal, for the hills were steep. It was all open, park-like country, with no roads or houses in sight. Scattered trees, never thick enough to be a forest, were everywhere. Shasta, who had lived all his life in an almost treeless grassland, had never seen so many or so many kinds of trees. If you had been there, you probably would have known, but he didn't, that he was seeing oaks, beeches, silver birches, rowans, and some chestnuts. Rabbits scurried away in every direction as they advanced, and presently they saw a whole herd of fallow deer making off among trees. "Isn't it simply gorgeous?" said Arvris. At the first ridge, Shasta turned in the saddle and looked back. There was no sign of Tashban, the desert, unbroken, except by the narrow green crack, which they traveled down, spread across the horizon. "Hello," he said abruptly. "What's that?" "What's what?" said Bree, turning around. Wynne and Arvis did the same. "That," said Shasta, pointing. "It looks like smoke. Is it a fire?"
"Sandstorm, I should think," said Bree.
"Not much wind to rise it," said Arvis. "Oh!" exclaimed Wynne. "Look! There are things flashing in it. Look! Their helmets and armor, and it's moving this way."
"By Tash," said Arvis, "it's the army. It's Rabadash."
"Oh, of course it is," said Wynne. "Just what I was afraid of. Quick, we must get to Anvard before it." And without another word, she whisked around and began galloping north. Bree tossed his head and did the same.
"Come on, Bree, come on," yelled Arvis over his shoulder.
This race was very grueling for the horses. As they topped each ridge, they found yet another valley and another ridge beyond it. And though they knew they were going in more or less the right direction, no one knew how far it was to Anvard. From the top of the second ridge, Shasta looked back again. Instead of a dust cloud well out in the desert, he now saw a blank, moving mass, rather like ants on the far bank of the Winding Arrow. They were doubtless looking for a ford.
"They're at the river," he yelled wildly.
"Quick, quick," shouted Arvis. "We might as well not have come at all if we don't reach Anvard in time. Gallop, Bree, gallop. Remember, you're a war horse." It was all Shasta could do to prevent himself from shouting out similar instructions. But he thought, the poor chap's doing all he can already, and he held his tongue. And certainly both horses were doing, if not all they could, all they thought they could, which was not quite the same thing. Bree had caught up with Wynne, and they thundered side by side over the turf. It didn't look as if Wynne could possibly keep up much longer. At that moment, everyone's feelings were completely altered by the sound from behind. It was not, of course, not the sound that they were expecting to hear. The noise of hooves and jingling armor mixed perhaps with Calamarine cries. Yet Shasta knew it at once. It was the same snarling roar he had heard that moonlit night when they first met Arvis and Wynne. Bree knew it too. His eyes gleamed red and his ears lay flat back against his skull, and Bree now discovered that he had not really been going as fast, not quite as fast as he could. Shasta felt the change at once. Now they were really going all out. In a few seconds, they were well ahead of Owen.
"It's not far," thought Shasta. "I did think we'd be safe from lions here."
He looked over his shoulder. Everything was only too clear. A huge, tawny creature, its body low to the ground like a cat streaking across the lawn to a tree when a strange dog got into the garden was behind them. It was very near every second and half second. He looked forward again and saw something which he did not take in or even think about. Their way was barred by a smooth green wall about 10 feet high. In the middle of that wall there was a gate open. In the middle of the gateway stood a tall man, dressed down to his bare feet in a robe colored like autumn leaves, leaning on a straight staff. His beard fell almost to his knees. Shasta saw all this in a glance, and then looked back again. The lion had almost got to Wynne now. It was making snaps at her hind legs, and there was no hope now for her foam-flecked, wide-eyed face.
Stop, bellowed Shasta in Bree's ear. Must go back, must help. Bree always said afterwards that he never heard or never understood this, and he was in general a very truthful horse. We must accept his word. Shasta slipped his feet out of the stirrups, slid both his legs over the left side, hesitated for one hideous hundredth of a second, and then jumped. It hurt horribly and nearly winded him, but before he knew it, or knew how hurt he was, he staggered back to help Ivers. He did, however, he had never done anything like this in his life before and hardly knew why he was doing it now. One of the most terrible noises in the world, a horse's scream, broke from Huen's lips. Ivers was stooping low over Huen's neck and seemed to be trying to draw her sword. And now all three, Ivers, Huen, and the lion, were almost on top of Shasta. Before they reached him, the lion rose on his hind legs, larger than you would have believed a lion could, and jabbed at Ivers with his right paw. Shasta could see the terrible claws extended. Ivers screamed and reeled in the saddle. The lion was tearing her shoulders. Shasta, half mad with horror, managed to lurch towards the brute. He had no weapon, not even a stick or a stone. He shouted out idiotically at the lion as one would at a dog. Go home! Go home! For fraction of a second, he was staring right into its wide-opened, raging mouth. Then, to his utter astonishment, the lion, still on its hind legs, chucked itself, turned head over heels, picked itself up, and rushed away. Shasta did not for a moment suppose it had gone for good. He turned and raced for the gate in the green wall, which, now for the first time, he remembered seeing. Huen, stumbling and nearly fainting, was just entering the gate. Ivers still kept her seat, but her back was covered with blood. Come in, my daughter, come in, the robed and bearded man was saying, and then, come in, my son, as Shasta panted up to him. He heard the gate close behind them, and the bearded stranger was already helping Ivers off her horse. They were in a wide and perfectly circular enclosure, protected by a high wall of green turf. A pool of perfectly still water, so full that the water was almost exactly level with the ground, lay before him. At one end of the pool, completely overshadowing it with its branches, there grew the hugest and most beautiful tree that Shasta had ever seen. Beyond this pool was a little low house of stone, roofed with deep and ancient thatch. There was a sound of bleating, and over at the far side of the enclosure there were some goats. The level ground was completely covered with the finest grass. Are you, panted Shasta, are you King Loon of Archenland? The old man shook his head. No, he replied in a quiet voice. I am the Hermit of the Southern March. And now, my son, waste no time in questions, but obey. This damsel is wounded. Your horses are spent. Rabadash is at this moment finding a ford over the winding arrow. If you run now without a moment's rest, you will still be in time to warn King Loon. Shasta's heart fainted at the words, where he felt he had no strength left. He writhed and sighed at what seemed the cruelty and unfairness of this demand. He had not yet learned that if you do one good deed, your reward usually is to be set to do another, and harder, and better one. But all he said out loud was, "Where is the king?" The hermit turned and pointed with his staff. "Look," he said, "there's another gate right opposite the one you entered by. Open it and go straight ahead, always straight ahead, over level or steep, over smooth or rough, dry or wet. I know by my art that you will find King Loon straight ahead, but run, run, always run." Shasta nodded his head, ran to the northern gate, and disappeared beyond it. Then the hermit took Arvis, whom he had all this time been supporting with his left arm, and half led, half carried her into the house. After a long time, he came out again. "Now, cousins," he said to the horses, "it is your turn." Without waiting for an answer, and indeed they were too exhausted to speak, he took the bridles and saddles off of them. Then he rubbed them both down so well that a groom in the king's stable could not have done it better. "There, cousins," he said, "dismiss it all from your minds and be comforted. Here is water and there is grass. You shall all have a hot mash when I have milked my other cousins, the goats." "Sir," said Huen, finding her voice at last, "will the Tarquino live? Has the lion killed her?" "I, who know many present things by my art," replied the hermit with a smile, "have yet little knowledge of things future. Therefore, I do not know whether any man or woman or beast in the whole world will be alive when the sun sets tonight. But be of good hope. The damsel is likely to live as long as any her age. When Iris came to herself, she found that she was lying on her face on a low bed of extraordinary softness in a cool, bare room with walls of undressed stone. She couldn't understand why she had been laid on her face, but when she tried to turn and felt the hot, burning pains all over her back, she remembered and realized why. She couldn't understand what delightfully springy stuff the bed was made of, because it was made of heather, which is, of course, the best bedding, and heather was a thing she had never seen, much less heard of. The door opened, and the hermit entered, carrying a large wooden bowl in his hand. After carefully setting this down, he came to the bedside and asked, "How do you find yourself, my daughter?" "My back is very sore, father," said Arbus, "but there is nothing else wrong with me." He knelt beside her, laid his hand on her forehead, and felt her pulse. "There is no fever," he said. "You will do well. Indeed, there is no reason why you should not get up tomorrow. But now drink this." He fetched the wooden bowl and held it to her lips. Arbus couldn't help making a face when she tasted it, for goat's milk is rather a shock when you're not used to it. But she was very thirsty and managed to drink it all and felt better when she had finished. "Now, my daughter, you may sleep when you wish," said the hermit, "for your wounds are washed and dressed, and though they smart, they are no more serious than if they had been cuts of a whip. It must have been a very strange lion, for indeed, instead of catching you out of the saddle and getting his teeth into you, he's only drawn his claws across your back. 10 scratches. Sore, but not deep or dangerous." "I say," said Arbus, "I have had luck." "Daughter," said the hermit, "I have now lived 109 winters in this world, and I've never yet met any such thing as luck. There is something about all this that I did not understand, but if ever we need to know, you may be sure that we shall." "And what about Rabadash and his 200 horses?" asked Arbus. "They will not pass this way, I think," said the hermit. "They must have found a ford by now, well to the east of us. From there they will try to ride straight toward Anvard." "Poor Shasta," said Arbus. "Has he far to go? Will he get there first?" "There is a good hope of it," said the old man. Arbus lay down again on her side this time and said, "Have I been asleep for a long time? It seems to be getting dark." The hermit was looking out of the only window which faced north. "This is not the darkness of night," he said presently. "Clouds are falling down from the storm in his head. Our foul weather always comes from there in these parts. There will be thick fog tonight." Next day, except for her sore back, Iris felt so well that after breakfast, which was porridge and cream, the hermit said she could get up. And, of course, she at once went out to speak to the horses. The weather had changed, and the whole of that green enclosure was filled like a great green cup with sunlight. It was a very peaceful place, lonely and quiet. Queen at once trotted across to Arbus and gave her a horse kiss. "But where's Bree?" said Arbus when they had asked after each other's health and sleep. "Over there," Queen pointed with her nose to the far side of the circle. "And I wish you'd come and talk to him. There's something wrong. I can't get a word out of him." They strolled across and found Bree lying on with his face towards the wall. And though he must have heard them coming, he never turned his head or spoke a word. "Good morning, Bree," said Arbus. "How are you this morning?" Bree muttered something that no one could hear. "The hermit says that Shasta probably got to King Loon in time," continued Arbus. "So it looks as if all of our troubles are over. Narnia at last, Bree." "I shall never see Narnia," said Bree in a low voice. "Are you well, Bree dear?" asked Arbus. "I shall go back to Calamarin," he said. "What?" said Arbus. "Back to slavery?" "Yes," said Bree. "Slavery is all I'm fit for. How can I ever show my face among the free horses of Narnia? I, who left a mare and a girl and a boy to be eaten by lions, while I galloped all I could to save my own wretched skin." "We all ran as hard as we could," said Hwin. "Shasta didn't," snorted Bree. At least he ran in the right direction, ran back, and that is what shames me most of all. I, who called myself a warhorse and boasted of 100 fights, to be beaten by a little human boy, a child, a mere fool, who had never held a sword, nor had any good nurture or example in his life. I know, said Arvrus. I felt just the same. Shasta was marvelous. Just as bad as you, Bree. I've been snubbing him and looking down on him ever since you met us, and now he turns out to be the best of us all. But I think it would be better to stay and say we're sorry than go back to Calmarin. It's all very well for you, said Bree. You haven't disgraced yourself, but I've lost everything. My good horse, said the hermit, who had approached them unnoticed because his bare feet made so little noise on that sweet, dewy grass. My good horse, you've lost nothing but your self-conceit. No, no, cousin. Don't put back your ears and shake your mane at me. If you are really so humble as you sounded a minute ago, you must learn to listen to sense. You're not quite the great horse you'd come to think from living among poor dumb horses. Of course you are braver and cleverer than them. You could hardly help being that. It doesn't follow that you'll be anyone very special in Narnia. But as long as you know you're nobody very special, you'll be a very decent sort of horse on the whole. And taking one thing with another. And now, if you and my other four-footed cousin will come round to the kitchen door, we'll see about the other half of that mash.